Welcome to BFR Radio, a podcast dedicated to all things blood flow restriction training. This podcast is proudly sponsored by the BFR.co, where if you want to buy your own BFR cuffs, access online BFR training programs, increase your own BFR knowledge, or you want more information about this type of training, this is your one place to go. And I'm your host, Dr. Chris Gaviglio. Welcome back to BFR Radio. Hope you're doing well. And I hope you enjoyed the last series of article reviews on how BFR can positively affect cognitive function. This has lots of applicability to the aging population, and this got me thinking about how we could potentially incorporate BFR into concussion protocols. Although speculative, a few of the mechanisms and pathways that BFR activates are not only related to brain function or cognitive function, but also improved brain function that's affected by concussion. Now, this episode is going to take me a bit of time to put together for a podcast. So for today's podcast, I'm actually going to do a very recent article review on the use of BFR in ACL rehab, in particular acute rehab. I've covered this topic in previous episodes in different pieces, but as this was a recent article, which is published in the Aspitar Sports Medicine Journal, I thought it was a good opportunity to go through this article. I really think this is a timely topic here in Australia in particular, with a lot of the football codes and other sporting codes such as netball are beginning their season. And with a high prevalence of knee injuries in the sports, hopefully this article and this podcast can help you or an athlete that you coach. The article that I'm going to review is called The Use of Blood Flow Restriction in Early Stage Rehabilitation Following ACL Injury: Implications for Enhancing Return to Play. The primary author is Stephen Patterson from the UK, who is a prolific author in the BFR research space. It is a short article which synthesizes a lot of the current information so far. If we start the article off and look at the background of ACL injuries, they are one of the most prevalent musculoskeletal conditions worldwide, totaling approximately 250,000 cases per year. ACL injuries are common in both males and females, occurring at an average age of 30 years, with an increasingly high annual incidence in all activity levels, from recreational to professional sports. While conservative treatment options exist, more often, patients require ACL reconstruction surgery by means of allograft or autograft to restore the ligamentous structure and thus the anterior to posterior stability of the knee joint. The ACL is responsible for providing stability to the knee, preventing excessive forward movement of the shin bone, the tibia, relative to the thigh bone, which is the femur, and controlling rotation of the knee joint. For an autograft ACL reconstruction, in this procedure, a healthy tendon from another part of the patient's body, such as the hamstring or patellar tendon, is used to replace the torn ACL. Whereas for an allograft ACL reconstruction, in this procedure, a donor ligament from a deceased individual or someone else is used to replace the torn ACL. The typical approach to ACL reconstruction rehabilitation has shifted from full limb immobilization post-surgery to early restoration of range of movement, weight bearing, and increased muscle activation. However, even with more accelerated and aggressive rehabilitation, a major consequence of ACL injury and subsequent reconstruction is significant thigh muscle atrophy and muscle weakness in the first weeks post-surgery. And this can persist for several years post-operation. There are many short-term and long-term consequences of ACL reconstruction, such as decreased protein turnover, strength loss, arthrogenic inhibition, which is a phenomenon in which the activation of one joint inhibits the activation of another joint, an increased risk of osteoarthritis, and also re-injury. The effects of muscle atrophy are unavoidable given the reduced weight bearing and unloading context of ACL reconstruction rehabilitation related to concerns of graft strain, cartilage damage, bone bruising, and meniscal injury, which often serve as contraindications to heavy load exercise to regain that muscle strength and size. Additionally, muscle physiology appears to be altered after ACL reconstruction, with signs of greater extracellular matrix and fewer satellite cells than prior to surgery. The extracellular matrix, which is a complex network of components that provide structural and biochemical support to surrounding cells, and might suggest an increased effort by the body to reinforce or repair the muscle tissue, potentially leading to stiffer muscles due to the additional scaffolding and less functional muscle tissue. Concurrently, the reduction in satellite cells, which are really important for muscle repair and growth, could impede the muscle's capacity to heal and regenerate, thus affecting overall muscle function and rehabilitation progress. As a result, the ability to find alternative rehabilitation tools that could help to improve the situation and recovery process is something that we are constantly on the lookout for. This is where the addition of blood flow restriction as a training modality can assist in the early rehabilitation post-ACL reconstruction due to its low load nature and hypertrophic capacity. Additionally, despite misconception, low load BFR is a safe and effective clinical rehabilitation tool when applied correctly. Published research provides promising evidence of the effectiveness of BFR training in the early phases of rehabilitation post-ACL reconstruction. In the UK National Health Service, this same group of researchers examined the effectiveness of BFR training compared to standard care rehabilitation in the first 3 months following ACL surgery. Using a criteria-driven approach, patients began resistance training at approximately 21 days post-surgery. Using a leg press exercise, patients were randomized to either BFR training of 4 sets using the 75 rep protocol, which is first set 30 reps, followed by 3 sets of 15 at 30% of their 1RM, or they used the standard care heavy load training regime, which was 3 sets of 10 repetitions at 70% of their 1RM. And they performed this twice a week for 8 weeks. Over the 8 weeks of training, significant and comparable increases in muscle thickness and pronation angle were observed for both training modalities. For muscle thickness, improvements of 5.8 to 6.7% and increases in pronation angle of around 3 to 3.5% were observed for both types of training. Increase in muscle size and strength is something we're familiar with, but we haven't really covered muscle pronation angle a lot in these podcasts. And as a bit of a background, this is the angle between the muscle fibers and the line of force of the muscle. Muscles, they're structured in different ways to optimize their function. Some are designed for power, while others are designed for endurance. The advantage of an increased pronation angle is that it allows for more muscle fibers, and therefore more contractile units, to be packed into a given muscle volume, enhancing the muscle's capacity to generate force. An advantage for anyone, and more specifically, athletes. Significant and comparable increases in leg press strength were observed in the injured leg with both BFR training and heavy load training. Interestingly, BFR training appeared to attenuate knee extensor strength loss at faster speeds, possibly indicating a reduction in the arthrogenic inhibition. In addition to muscle hypertrophy and strength adaptations, clinically meaningful improvements in several measures of physical function have been observed with BFR training in other studies, of which these outcomes were all significantly better than heavy load training. The authors of this study thought that this may be due in part to the greater reduction in knee pain and swelling found with subjects performing BFR training over that traditional heavy load resistance training. One of the points that continually comes up with BFR training is whether it's safe. To date, the research has highlighted that using BFR training during rehabilitation post-ACL reconstruction appears to be safe and practically feasible. No adverse effects on knee laxity have been found with BFR training compared to heavy load training. It's also been shown both acutely and chronically that patients experience less knee pain during and for up to 24 hours post-exercise with BFR, with a greater overall reduction in pain following 8 weeks of training. Moreover, the perceived exertion and muscle pain responses to BFR training appears not to limit application or adherence to training. Similar findings have been found in post-surgical BFR studies in the US military as well. If anyone knows how hard BFR training feels, this kind of response is another positive outcome. Before continuing, I just want to repeat that point about BFR and knee pain. BFR is a fantastic tool for decreasing pain. There is a lot of evidence in literature, and personally, I can attest to the wonders of using BFR movement to assist with decreasing pain across a wide range of different joints and areas of the body. In particular, if we just want to focus on the knee for 1 second again, that there is a colleague of mine who he ended up getting both knees replaced. And before he did that, he was in immense pain. He spoke about it was like having glass in those knee joints. And when I introduced him to the wonders of BFR, he would squat with them on. And he would say we'd get up to 24 hours of pain relief from squatting with those cuffs on. Once again, just reinforcing that point earlier with other studies that have also shown similar effects. Back to the article, it then discusses the different phases of BFR usage following ACL reconstruction. The article focuses on the first two acute phases, hence the title of the paper. If we look at the initial early phase, the primary post-operative goals of ACL reconstruction is to reduce joint effusion, pain control, and combat muscle atrophy and strength loss, a pretty important phase. And during this phase, unloading of the muscle causes significant muscle loss. Therefore, passive BFR, which is the application of BFR without exercise, is a really great way to start using it during this phase. Passive BFR creates an increase in cellular swelling that is evident after the release of the cuff, which may increase muscle protein synthesis and suppress muscle breakdown. Passive BFR can be applied using a protocol of 5 sets of 5 minutes of full restriction followed by 3 minutes of rest and reperfusion to decrease muscle atrophy and also to decrease the amount of strength loss of the quadriceps muscles. In addition, you can look at adding voluntary isometric contractions with the BFR, which may increase metabolic stress and cell swelling levels above just passive BFR only, and once again, contribute to an improvement in that muscle hypertrophy, acting also as a preparation phase for the subsequent low-load BFR exercise that you would progress to. This first phase can begin a few days post-surgery, provided that inflammation, pain, and swelling are not excessive, and patients have passed a risk assessment questionnaire. The addition of neuromuscular electrical stimulation, such as using a Compex or pain dot, combined with BFR is another option in the acute phase of ACL reconstruction. Although this is more of a novel concept, studies have been done combining low-intensity neuromuscular electrical stimulation with BFR, and they've found increases in muscle size and strength greater than either intervention by themselves. Concerning ACL reconstruction, the advantage of using neuromuscular electrical stimulation on the quadriceps is that it does not involve the transmission of large forces through the tibiofemoral joint, which provides a low risk of damaging the graft or exacerbating any cartilage, meniscal, or bone injuries. Mitigating the loss of muscle strength and size in the acute stages of rehabilitation is necessary to improve the ability to perform voluntary training later in the rehabilitation process. Therefore, if you are looking at introducing a protocol that provides the best possible outcome, the addition of neuromuscular electrical stimulation with BFR may be a more effective approach in the first early post-operative phase. And also, although the article only talks about using neuromuscular electrical stimulation on the quadricep, you start to actually then think about other muscles such as the hamstring, the calf complex, and you can even do some work where you can put them on your feet. Therefore, if you are a running athlete, you're actually able to hit a greater spectrum of muscle groups that you would use when you're running, so that when you do start running, that your feet, your calves, and your hamstrings are able to tolerate that load just a little bit better, because it's really important to maintain those strength levels as much as you can. As we progress along and the range of motion is returned and the gait is normalized, low load resistance with BFR should be introduced to accelerate muscle hypertrophy and improve strength. There's a lot of available literature that indicates low load BFR training is an effective, tolerable, and useful clinical musculoskeletal rehabilitation tool. Looking at the underlying mechanisms, one of the benefits of engaging in low load resistance training while using BFR techniques is its proven ability to increase the process of muscle protein synthesis. Muscle protein synthesis is essentially the muscle's way of repairing and building itself stronger after exercise by creating new proteins. This beneficial effect is believed to stem from the activation of a specific cellular signaling pathway known as mTOR, or the mechanistic target of rapamycin. The mTOR pathway plays a really important role in controlling protein synthesis in cells. When activated, it signals the muscle cells to begin the process of building more proteins, which are the building blocks of muscle tissue. Therefore, exercises that incorporate BFR seem to effectively trigger this pathway, therefore enhancing the muscle's ability to repair and grow by synthesizing more protein than it would under normal circumstances without using BFR. Such increases in muscle protein synthesis with low loads can help recover and increase muscle size without loading the post-operative knee joint with heavy loads, which are traditionally required for such adaptations. Traditional strength training typically requires a minimum of 60 to 70% of a person's maximum capacity, or in strength terms, their one repetition maximum, to elicit the necessary pathway activation and subsequent increases in muscle size and strength. With BFR, only having to use low loads at 20 to 30% of a person's maximum is required to produce these desirable changes in muscle size and strength. Perfect for this scenario and perfect for rehab. Another benefit of low load BFR strength exercise is the early preferential recruitment of type 2 fast twitch fibers at low loads. Thought to be an important mechanism behind strength adaptations at these low loads, BFR exercise, it appears that the normal size principle of muscle recruitment is reversed. Fast twitch fibers, which are more susceptible to atrophy and activation deficits during unloading, are normally only recruited at high intensities of muscular work. During low load resistance training with BFR, it appears that they are recruited earlier. Indeed, several studies have demonstrated increased muscle activation during low load BFR resistance exercise. Greater internal activation intensity has been found relative to external load during low load BFR resistance training, suggesting type 2 fibers are preferentially recruited. This preferential recruitment of the type 2 fibers that are more susceptible to atrophy during the early stages of ACL rehab may help combat the arthrogenic inhibition. This, once again, is where muscle weakness occurs, not because of the injury to the muscle itself, but due to a problem within the joint, such as pain, swelling, or mechanical restriction. And it can also assist with triggering muscle hypertrophy and recovery of strength. And if you play sport, the ability to prevent fast twitch muscle fiber atrophy, or decreases in fast twitch muscle fiber size, is, you would think, would be a beneficial outcome as well. So how do we go about using BFR in a practical setting? This section could be a series of podcasts on its own. However, some focus points from the article is that recent research supports the individualization of BFR application, where BFR is prescribed as a percentage of arterial limb occlusion pressure, or LOP, L-O-P, which represents the minimum pressure required for total arterial occlusion of that limb. Manipulation of BFR protocols have been shown to influence the perceptual hemodynamic, or the dynamics of blood flow within the circulatory system, and neuromuscular responses to BFR exercise. In this article, the authors have put together two fantastic tables which outline practical guidelines for implementing BFR with respect to frequency, load, restriction time, type of muscle groups targeted, number of sets, repetitions, and related rest periods and restriction types, i.e. is the pressure continuously applied during the exercise protocol, or is it intermittently inflated and deflated? So if you're really into this type of training, go dig the paper out and have a look at that. Summarizing this for you though, table one presents guidelines designed to optimize the benefits of BFR training during the initial passive phase of rehab. It is suggested that BFR training should be performed 1 to 2 times per day, which aligns with the period of bed rest or immobilization after an injury. Each BFR session should include 5-minute intervals of applied restriction. This type of passive use of BFR can be utilized for both small and large muscle groups, whether on one side of the body, that's unilateral, or both sides, bilateral. The suggested number of sets ranges between 3 to 5. Between each set, a rest period of 3 to 5 minutes is advised. The exact pressure to be used is uncertain, but it is suggested that a higher pressure might be needed, estimated to be around 70 to 100% of limb occlusion pressure or LOP. The restriction is to be maintained continuously throughout the exercise session or that passive period where you have it inflated. Then we look at table two, which outlines the guidelines for phase two of resistance training with BFR. And this phase is designed to enhance the effectiveness of resistance training with BFR for improved muscle adaptation and growth. It specifies that training should occur 1 to 2 times per day during the initial 1 to 3 weeks, and then 2 to 3 times a week if it extends beyond 3 weeks. The recommended load for exercise is light, at 20 to 40% of the individual's 1 repetition maximum. And if you don't know what your 1 repetition maximum is, you can estimate it. Start off light and be sensible. Each exercise should involve a restriction time of approximately 5 to 10 minutes, with reperfusion, that's releasing the cuff or restoring the blood flow, occurring between exercises. So we're playing it safe here. This phase of training is suitable for both small and large muscle groups and can be applied to one side, that's unilateral, and both sides, bilateral of the body. The number of sets should be between 2 to 4, and a high number of repetitions is suggested, such as the 75 rep protocol, or using an alternative structure, which is something that I recommend more often, that still uses high reps, but rather uses muscle failure or fatigue as a guide to terminate the set. The pressure applied should be between 40 to 80% of limb occlusion pressure. Rest periods between the sets are short, at 30 to 60 seconds. The restriction can be applied continuously or intermittently throughout the exercise. The speed of execution for the muscle contractions, both concentric and eccentric, should be controlled at approximately 1 to 2 seconds on each phase. The exercise should be performed until the muscle can no longer sustain contraction, that's concentric failure, or until the predetermined repetition scheme is completed. My only addition to table two would be that when extending beyond 3 weeks and in the acute phase, BFR could still be effectively used daily. And in particular, when you're trying to accelerate the outcomes in the rehab phase, that not only could you be using it daily, but multiple times throughout the day, and then incorporating the BFR with your low intensity cardiovascular work and your upper body training as well, really to maximize all the benefits of BFR. Then as the athlete progresses through the stages of their rehab program, the next question is, when can they return to sport following surgery? Generally speaking, it's common for patients to be at a higher risk of re-injury compared to healthy controls. There are a range of assessments to determine an athlete's readiness to return to sport, including subjective rating scales, knee laxity testing, isokinetic testing, functional hop testing, balance testing, and also movement assessments. This article and podcast isn't going into that. Whilst the ability to assess readiness to return to sport has improved over several years, several studies have demonstrated deficits in muscular strength, kinesthetic sense, balance, and force attenuation 6 months to 2 years following reconstruction. With this in mind, the return to sport following ACL reconstruction should not be rushed. Overall, the mounting evidence suggests that BFR could be used to mitigate some of these residual deficits that people experience. Overall, BFR provides a safe and efficient treatment modality for athletes following ACL reconstruction. As it gains more acceptance in clinical settings and more robust clinical trials are published, there has been a shift in the insight of its usage and adoption. Clinical trials have advanced not just to explore the ability of BFR to preserve and restore lost muscle mass and strength, but there is evidence to show its ability to preserve bone loss after ACL reconstruction and help to reduce pain, swelling, and improve function. More recent advancements have also advocated its use in prehabilitation prior to ACL reconstruction surgery, with a desirable reduction of muscle fibrosis and upregulation of satellite cells and improved return to play outcomes. Personally, I like this article. For a succinct article, it encompasses and summarizes the multiple uses of BFR from pre to post surgery really effectively. Although this article focuses just on the acute phase of the rehabilitation process, onwards from the first two acute phases of the rehab process, there is definitely a place for BFR ongoing in the athlete training program and could continue to be a performance enhancement tool long after the ACL rehab continuum. As the author states in the last message of the article to clinicians and athletes alike, train hard, train smart, and start early. I hope you enjoyed this article review. Again, it's a timely reminder with a lot of sports starting their season, and already we are seeing the occurrence of ACL injuries on the sporting field. For me, I can't stress how good BFR is as a rehab tool across a spectrum of different injuries. But in the case of this article review, BFR is a fantastic tool to enhance the recovery from ACL reconstruction. If there is something specific you'd like me to go into further detail, let me know, and perhaps this could form another informative podcast for you. And that's all for this episode. If this episode has sparked your own interest in starting an exercise regime, get in touch with me through my website, which is thebfr.co, or socials at thebfr on Instagram. You can also purchase your own BFR cuffs from our website, and you can find that also at thebfr.co. And lastly, before I go, a couple of favors from me to you. If you know of someone who would benefit from this episode, please share it. And if you are enjoying the podcast, please give it a rating on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and remember to keep the pump.